Redskins, Dodo Heads, Tepid Lemonade. Get out of it. Redskins, Dodo Heads, Tepid Lemonade.
Hey, mate, I'll take five of your Redskins and one of those Tepid Lemonades.
It's one chicken, mate. It's not a chicken.
No. No, that's much better than a chicken, my friend. That is gold.
What?
Gold. The currency of the future.
Great. Come back in the future.
Redskins. No, mate, I don't think you understand. This has unlimited use.
Can I eat it?
No.
Can I wear it?
No.
Can I use it as firewood?
No.
It's starting to sound pretty limited, mate.
But you can melt it and then turn it into whatever you want.
Can I turn it into food?
No, you can't eat it.
Is this going to take long?
Hold all your horses, mate. We are dealing in futures here.
Ooh, what's that? Is that a rock?
No, worse. It's cold.
Gold. Ooh, cold. How do I get some cold?
Gold. I have people mining for it.
Oh, you have people. La-dee-da.
We've got a rich one here, eh?
What do you pay them with?
Gold.
Next.
No, they say that this currency could be worth 1,000 Redskins, maybe even more, in just a few years.
Says who?
The people with gold.
Fuck. Next!
Look, every economy ever has been controlled by the big chicken banks.
Next!
And this is our opportunity to get out from under the big chicken boots.
Fuck me.
Next. Shake up the market and start taking back our economic independence. Are you with me?
No.
Really? Come on, man. Look, all my mates are doing it.
I'll just get your hand off it, all right? Everyone's trying to predict the next alt rock. First it was stone, then bronze, then iron, now gold. What can I even do with this shiny shit? Make fucking jewelry out of it or something?
Yes. Yes, you can do that. Great idea, because it's malleable. And best part of all, there's fuck all of it. It's a finite resource.
Mate, I'll tell you what a finite resource is. My fucking patience, all right? Now piss off.
You know what? Stuff it. I'm taking it back. That's like talking to my dad.
Yeah. Why don't you go discover avocado and smash it on toast, you dickhead?
Yeah, maybe I will.
Sorry, mate.
I'll have a dodo head, thanks.
Half a chicken. Piss on me, not you two.
What up, vigilantes? I'm here with the one and only Ed Bugos. In the world of crypto, if you don't understand Austrian economics, you're going to be lost. And the reason why that is nothing more than the fact that cryptocurrency is a manifestation of the Austrian school of thought in the real market. Ed Bugos, how are you doing today?
I'm great. Yourself, Raphael?
I'm doing great. So for everyone watching right now, guys, you're about to enter into a conversation where I talk to one of my most important senseis. When it comes to economics, to finance, to traditional finance, Ed Bugos is the head of research at the Crypto Vigilante, co-founder of the Dollar Vigilante and Crypto Vigilante. Ed, thank you for giving us your time today, and let's get into it. How did you get into being the man that you are today? How is it that you became enamored with Austrian economics?
The internet.
So were you, before that, was your formal education in economics or
yes,
did
yes,
you?
Yes. Okay. Yes. So I had the traditional dream of becoming a M&A specialist and Wall Street trader and all that stuff when I was a kid. And so I went to school, and it was a socialist university here, Simon Fraser University in British Columbia in Canada. And, I went there for a few years, and they shoved a lot of Keynesianism and Marxism and stuff like that down our throat, and some neoclassical school too, and maybe some real economics in the first couple years, I think, in the microeconomic side, a little bit, but for the most part, I never heard of, Mises or the Austrian school. I think the closest that I came to anything that you could call economics for sure was the Friedman school. But the only exposure I had to Friedman was in the ethical side. They didn't really teach us Chicago economics at, you know, in our, they taught us some parts of it because there's always, because, you know, these schools, when you call them Austrian school or Chicago school or the neoclassical school, what all these schools, there's really just, there's economics, you know, economics is a science, right? And the reason you have the schools is because they have disagreements about, you know, how to approach that science. Okay. The Austrian school is the only one that has a, what we call a value-free approach, where the axioms and laws are, they're derived a priori before experience, just deductively through logic and reason from an original axiom that humans act. So, you know, Ludwig von Mises wrote a book called Human Action, and he wrote about the concept of what does it mean for humans to act? And so he defined some of the properties, and then from there, axiomatically determined a theory, right? And some of it is already sort of been absorbed into general economic theory, you know, like the idea of subjective value, right? That value is subjective and not objective. The cost of production theory. Some economists in academia may still push that. But in the real world, you learn, you know. So, you know, and so I left Socialist University in about year three, you know, just a year before I graduated, because I was really eager to get going in finance and as a stockbroker. And you know, I'd heard that you only take there's basically just a short course, the Canadian Securities course, to get a license. So, you know, it was no problem. We got a license. Now they have all sorts of courses and all sorts of hoops that you have to jump through. But none of them really teach you anything, you know, in my opinion, really substantial about economics and the way that life works. But again, economics is just one tool in our basket, right? So, you know, as a trader, as an investor, economics is not necessary to succeed. Okay, you could be a good speculator with, you know, just a general understanding of charts, business sense, how to read financial statements, you know, and how if you have just sort of a normal worldview, not normal. Today's normal is not good, but a somewhat well balanced worldview. You could become a good speculator, but of course, you know, as some of my mentors have said in the past, you know, that the key about speculation is the real key about becoming a good trader and a good speculator is to know yourself and to know your weaknesses. So it's very important to know everything that everything about yourself, right? Because you could sabotage yourself in the market system, right? Or as a trader, I should say. Because the market system is pretty broad beyond just financial markets. So, I became a stockbroker. I plied my trade for 11, 12 years. I remember reading newsletters like Doug Casey's and others, and I always thought they were just a bit quacky, you know, because I hadn't yet been exposed to any sort of Austrian economics or any, contrarian side stuff. But slowly things started to sink in. And towards the end of it, you know, when we had we saw a tech bubble in 1999, where the NASDAQ did similar to what it's done, actually, in terms of trajectory and the length of the, you know, in the late 90s, the kind of bubble that we had in tech stocks, very, very similar to what we've just seen in the last, say, 5-6 years, right, on the NASDAQ. Because after the 2000 peak in the NASDAQ, it went into bear mode and it really never recovered until about 2014. It's like 14 years later. So in the last 5-6 years, you've seen most of the move in the NASDAQ. And it was very similar to the end of the 90s as well. And, you know, it was in the end of the 90s that I started questioning where what inflation is and where it comes from and stuff, because that's where my, you know, conditioning was meant to trip me up. And anyway, so the internet came around and I discovered the Ludwig von Mises's book on money, the theory of money and credit. And then from there, I just went down the Austrian lineage and Austrian school lineage and started to read everything. And, you know, today I feel like I've got a balanced idea of all the schools of economic thought. So I have some, most academics, you know, unless they're Austrian, if you're an Austrian scholar, you've been exposed to the other stuff. But if you're not, you know, if you've just got your economics training from XYZ University in Canada, you're probably not going to know anything about the Austrian school or Ludwig von Mises or marginal utility theory, really, or the business cycle theory or where money comes from, what money is, because they really don't. And, you know, even capital theory, they don't spend hardly any time on capital theory in either the Chicago school or the Keynesian school. So after being exposed to the real world for a number of years as a stockbroker, and after discovering the Austrian School of Economics, I kind of realized, well, this business is not what I thought it was going to be. You know, I had this dream of being a customer's man in the way they had stockbrokers in the old days, you know. But I found that it started to become so centralized. The banks were buying up all the brokerage firms, right? And then they started, instead of accepting brokers doing their own business dynamically, they all wanted everybody moving in the same direction, selling the products that they were creating at the banks, right? At the investment banking level, right? So it started to become, and you know, with the fractional reserve banking model as it is already a racket, right? It just, you know, racketized the whole brokerage business, you know, in the way that I saw it anyways. And so I gave up on it, and I started writing about gold, and gold was trading at $300 and it was being pushed down by the European bankers who had been leasing their gold to bullion dealers, gold miners who had been forwardly selling their gold underwritten by the bullion dealers. So the bullion dealers were really playing both sides of this, and they're pushing gold prices down for a while there in the late 90s. And I started to catch on to that when I saw news like the Bank of England was going to sell the final bit of its gold and so on. I thought, what the hell is going on? Something's going on, right? So that drove me into a number of questions that just led me down this path. So I started promoting gold as an investment strategy, but I couldn't do it as a broker. I had to leave. But that was fine because the internet was here and I could do things over the internet without having to worry about, you know, finding a desk that somebody else is going to underwrite for me to do my business and lord over me and so forth. So it was like a breath of fresh air to have some freedom, right? I tried a few different things, but writing sort of caught traction, and I went in that direction. Since then, my first letter lasted about 6 or 7 years, and then by 2006, everybody had caught on that there was a bull market in gold, and I felt like everything I'd written, I was starting to repeat, which is par for the course for this business. We have to do that in a lot of ways because we always get new people coming in and wanting to understand. So, you know, they have to find a balance between repeating some of the old and underscoring, but you end up getting better at saying what the matters are too. But anyway, so I had enough in 2006 and I left for a little while. And then I came back, in a stint with Agora Financial, and also I started up an investment banking partnership with some Americans in New Jersey. And so those things only lasted a few years. The investment banking partnership dissolved because the regulators started to make it too onerous for me, for my licensing and stuff, because I was in Canada and the firm was in the US. So they wanted FINRA to supervise me up here in Canada, and I just and of course in 2011 and 12 the commodity bull market melted away, so the investment banking business fizzled away, and Jeff and I started the Dollar Vigilante by then, right? And I was very and just to I'll get there really quick, so I was very reticent about being political, which I'm not anymore, as you know, right? But I always felt like if I'm going to get political, then I'm going to burn my bridges in the financial business, which is what I ended up doing, right? So you can't, and that's why I remember when I was a broker and I first ran into like Doug Casey kind of material, I thought it was so quacky, because that's how they see a lot of the kind of stuff that we do, right? It's an academic thing. It's an academic problem, right? They haven't expanded their horizons, a lot of them, right? They do just the bare minimum what the regulators ask them to do in terms of education, right? For the most part. And then even the ones that know, they play the game, right?
That's where we are. It's very interesting how you at heart are a scholar, but you use scholarship to help in guiding people in how you teach about the market in real time. Maybe you can explain that a little bit more so that people may understand that nuance there, that there is economics and there is scholarship, and then there's applied scholarship and what we do at the Crypto Vigilante, at the Dollar Vigilante.
Well, I don't want to call it scholarship, actually. I think of it in terms of more that, because a scholar implies that you're producing scholarly, contributing original theory to the body of knowledge, right? I'm not at that level, and I don't ever want to be. I'm extremely well-learned because I approach in whatever I do, whether it's cryptocurrencies or financial statements or economics or if I'm looking at a biotech deal, I'm going to become a really good student of biology and whatever is, you know, that kind of thing. And I approach these things very scientifically. I've with the Socratic method and, you know, internally, and I think what makes me, in my experience, when I look back, what makes me unique is that I ask the right questions. I don't know how to develop that skill, right, in people. But I think just, you know, people generally people don't like to think, right? And even most of my family wonders where I come from in terms of how I just continue to think past where everybody, that the boundaries that everybody else has enough of, right? So I like, the Austrian school really kind of grounded me a lot in that too, because they stress the causal realist approach, and that there's a causal chain. And economics is really, it's a lot of people think of it as common sense, but I had this discussion with my daughter the other day, and it's common sense is really what, you know, what everybody thinks. And economics is logical, but it actually deals with the remote causes of things, not the proximal causes of things, right? You know, everybody sees, like, when when we had the 2008 crisis, Lehman blew up and everybody blamed it on Lehman because that was the proximal cause that they saw of the financial crisis. But as economists, we're trained to look at, well, what was the cause of that? And what was the cause of that? And what was the cause of that, right? So So as economists, we're just trained to search out the remote causes. And as a scientist, I'm not a PhD or, you know, but in practice, I practice in a scientific way. You know, everything I try to understand is in a very scientific way, you know, and I try to be objective about it. And I question my point of view all the time, because as a portfolio manager, as an investment manager, the number one thing that my trainers have kind of ingrained in my head was eternal vigilance. I mean, you're always reevaluating your positions, always, right? Every bit of data that comes through, you don't just look at it as if you're in a vacuum. You just data related to your positions. Does it still make sense? Does my view still make sense? Does this reject my view? Does this confirm my view, et cetera, right?
So Ed, all of a sudden, Satoshi Nakamoto dropped the white paper.
Right.
What was your initial reaction? And take us through that like encounter with this new digital asset class.
At first, I wrote it off. I thought it was just going to be just a little scam, a little bit of fluff. I couldn't imagine how you could have what a Bitcoin was, you know. And the way it was explained to me in the beginning also was difficult. And I didn't read the white paper originally. I didn't get that far. I wrote it off as thinking silly, you know. I got caught up in this idea that money has to be tangible. And it took me a long time to realize that in this day and age, Ludwig von Mises' theory on money was that originally it was a commodity. And so everybody kind of runs with that and thinks, well, I guess that means that money has to be tangible. But what Mises meant, and Walter Block kind of figured this out first, was that when money was first developed, right, when money was first innovated as the solution to the problem of barter, right, that it was, you know, there was obviously there was no internet, no technical gadgets at that time per se, at least not in this form. In the digital form, and so in the original sense, when money was first invented as a solution and as a technical solution to the problem of exchange, it happened to be a tangible commodity. And because, you know, back then, you know, what else fit the properties of scarcity and fungibility and so on, but gold, right? So I like to say that gold was the world's natural sound money, right? It was the one that we adopted. But, see, you know, this is the thing, right? People forget that we adopted gold, right? A lot of people are taught also that the state created money, right? Because it was the first to officially mint certain coins, right? And so people just derive from that the state created money. But that's not how money got created. Money is a technical solution to the problem of exchange, right? It helps people. It helps people develop into a society based on a foundation of property and exchange and so on, right? Where they can coordinate their plans bottom up, so they don't have to rely on a top down plan, because prices, when they form, they allow people to make their own plans, right?
Yes. Yes.
So money is very instrumental to civilization in that sense and so forth. And it was adopted. And so gold's value is intertwined over time. The adoption, you know, when it was first adopted, there was no civilization, right? Now we have civilization, we have prices, things are priced in terms of dollars, right? So going from one money to another money should be no problem if there's no obstacles, but there's of course lots of obstacles, right? But what I found out when I started to take it seriously was in 2012-ish, maybe a little earlier than that, but around 2012, when I just started seeing people would would work for it, that they would give up their labor for this thing. At that point it was like, okay, is this a Ponzi scheme? So, you know, I wrote that off. Is this a fraud? No, I wrote that off. Right. I still didn't understand the value proposition behind it. But the insight that Block had about the money not necessarily needing to be tangible these days, as long as it has all the other properties, as long as it starts out with a transaction of value of some kind, right? There has to be a starting point of value, because that's what, you know, otherwise money has, the only reason we value money is because we know what it can buy, right? So to know how much you want to have on hand for your purchases, you have to know what the value of it is, right? So that's one of the unique things about money, is that it has to have an objective value in the first place. Whereas most goods, like consumer goods, they don't have to have an objective value for them to have value to you, right? To have utility to you, right? But in the case of money, it has to have an objective value for you to have, to see its value as a medium of exchange, right? But I learned that the fact that money is that gold is tangible, what I realized was that was its weakness eventually, because that's where you drew in the intermediaries, right? And when I started to understand this idea of trustless settlement and relatively instant settlement, because, you know, I know it's 10 minutes is a long time, but in terms of a cash transaction, but if you're doing a transaction of any size and got to move gold around, you know, gold is not going to be any quicker to settle than your Bitcoin transaction or your Monero transaction or whatever cryptocurrency you're using, right? If that's a thing, but whatever, that's another issue probably. But I realized that money doesn't have to be tangible, and I think a lot of people are hooked up on that because of Mises's regression theorem, but they have a misunderstanding of the regression theorem, right? In my opinion. So in 2014 and 15, I just went all out bullish on Bitcoin. And you know, once I realized these things, and now I see it as, you know, I know that we have different, you know, I know Bitcoin has its challenges, and I know it's not the ideal sound money. And I prefer Monero myself as well for that. But in the whole cryptocurrency, I mean, why does the first one have to be the perfect one anyways, right? You know, it was Satoshi threw a great nuclear bomb at the traditional system of theft. Okay. he threw a wonderful nuclear bomb at that. Okay.
Yes.
But it's evolved since then, right? And it'll take some time for the market to find which currency maybe it really wants to settle on that will challenge not just the crypto space, but the dollar, right? But that's coming. And despite obstacles, it's coming. You know, we've seen them just crush the crypto market with regulation, but all of a sudden, isn't it funny that they're all filing applications for an ETF now?
Yes, so, there's something very special about you, Ed, because where a lot of people see doom and gloom because of your background, you're actually very optimistic for the future, more so than what the popular culture within crypto, where they stand. You are much more positive because you understand the market dynamic and how people behave better. So, for example, you are not someone that is afraid of central bank digital currencies. And I've always thought that was very special. It's almost as if you have been for years now like a lone wolf explaining why people shouldn't be that concerned for central bank digital currencies. When we talk about people realizing sooner or later that there will be more valuable cryptocurrencies that are more useful and that have better properties of money than Bitcoin, what do you think about the fact that these powerhouses, the big tech and Silicon Valley, they control the media. And by controlling the media, they easily manipulate the attention of their audience, who they have under their possession within their centralized networks. So my question to you is, how do you see the people coming to this realization of something that's better than Bitcoin, like Monero, when there's so much noise in the environment leading them astray from coming to that realization?
You remember how what I said right off the bat when you asked me how I discovered economics or Austrian economics, and I said the internet?
Yes.
Right. Well, before the internet, if you go back to that period, they had real control over the media. They had control over information. If you wanted to know anything about a company, you'd have to either walk down to the library, or you would, if they had anything, because the company might be too new for the library to have anything, or you'd have to call your broker, right? And your broker would, you know, take your name and find out if you're worth sending the material to, right? So they have control over everything, okay? We take that for granted. So already when the internet came, I knew we were winning. You know, when the internet came, there are a lot of people on the conspiracy side who believed in, you know, people call me a conspiracy theorist. I don't have anything against conspiracy theorizing. I don't have anything against conspiracy theorists. I just think a lot of them are too lazy, you know, and not trained in economics and the way the world works enough. And they don't have enough perspective, a lot of them, okay? So the internet blew open the monopoly they had on information. You know, they're trying to get that back just now. You know, with, like, in Canada, they got Bill C-18 or whatever, where they're, you know, they're trying to make sure that Canadian news sources get paid for their stuff. But really, it's a plan to suppress the news that comes out of alternative media like Dan Dix and other, you know, the independent source. So another way to say that, another way to go with what you asked is that they don't control all of the media anymore. They control some of the media, right? The ones that the conglomerates and the corporations, the corporate media, right? But there's a large army of independent journalists and investigators and bloggers and newsletter writers that did not exist before the internet. Okay. And unfortunately, a lot of the noise comes from a lot of these people. Okay. And like I said, for the reasons I said, right. And the thing with CBDCs, nobody has stopped to ask, well, what exactly is a CBDC? Right. Well, wait a minute. What is a CBDC? Right. Could you give me a profile of how the average person might define a CBDC?
Well, the worst out there who are most sensational in describing it would say, well, it's the mark of the beast and you should run for the hills, right?
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I can give you my understanding of it all, but
not at all. I'm just looking for how let's define a central bank digital currency.
So it would be a centralized cryptocurrency that includes a digital ID that incorporates a social credit system that tracks and traces you, and at the same time serves as a system of surveillance and as a means of control by keeping you from doing anything that
You're going, wait, see, this is what I want to do, is I want to reduce it to what is a CBDC. I didn't ask what the whole system was going to be once a CBDC is installed, right? So what is a CBDC? What is a central bank digital currency, first of all? What is it?
Are you asking me what it is or what people think it is?
No, I'm asking what it is.
What it is. it's nothing more than the dollar, in my opinion. We already have a digital dollar. So a CBDC would be the incorporation of a digital ID alongside a digital dollar.
Okay, but hold on. All right.
A true CBDC.
What is the dollar today?
A dollar today?
What is a dollar?
94% of it is digital. So we are already
it's in bank a digital deposit dollar. Money. It's bank deposit money, right? Isn't it?
Yes.
Isn't money? If you look at the money supply, what's it made up of? Demand deposits and currency in circulation. Period, right? And I don't want to get into the debate about money market accounts and all the other bullshit that they attach to money supply, okay? But basically, it's demand deposits at banks plus currency in circulation, cash, okay? The definition of a dollar is that it's a Federal Reserve note, right? And the cash is issued by the Federal Reserve. But the money, right, in the banking system is a deposit liability of whatever bank you have your money in. You know, your money is a deposit liability. It's a money substitute originally, but now it's money. So your money today is a deposit liability. That's what it is. Now, if you say we're going to have a central bank digital currency, and you say, okay, all that means is we're going to eliminate cash, right? Then, like you say, we're 94% there.
Correct.
Okay. The way they have the system already today, they have the ability to surveil you. They have the ability to track you. They have the ability to freeze your accounts. You know, we had a big controversy about that with the truckers in Canada, right? You see the banks excluding Nigel Farage in the UK, right? They have the technology to do this, right? What stands in their way are economic problems, economic difficulties. In the same way that, you know, in the Crypto Vigilante newsletter, I wrote about the SDRs, the special drawing rights that the IMF created in the late 60s, okay? They've tried to make that a world currency forever. The reason they failed is as a matter of economic difficulties. It's not implementable on a worldwide basis by force. Okay, it's a lesson in economics here that governments can't just create currencies. You know, the euro was crafted by a crafty economist named Robert Mundell, who knew that the European currencies had a historical link to gold. So they designed it so that when the euro was going to be launching, the central banks were going to buy back the gold that they leased in the previous decade, right? Under what they call the central bank gold agreement. Okay. So they were careful that when they launched the euro, that they still had a tie to gold in people's minds.
Wow. Right? That is crafty.
Yeah. And that's why the BRICS, what we know so far, there's this murmur about gold, a gold link, because governments can't just create currencies, right? They can't. But in my analysis of the BRICS currency is the same as the dollar under the Bretton Woods currency, except worse, because you're dealing with countries that are traditionally way more inflationary than the U.S. When you're talking about, you know, Brazil, Russia, and India, and
South Africa, yeah.
Especially, yeah, South Africa is very socialist.
Yeah.
So there are limitations what you can do in terms of implementing a global government currency. The dollar is the best that they will ever fucking have. And you hear me? All right. The dollar would have died in the 70s, but they've kept that system together for as long as they could, right? but it's dying. They keep destroying it because they keep stealing too much, right? So they keep, and they can't help themselves, right? That's you know, like Doug says, they're fucking Jacobins. They're crazy, these people, right?
Yeah. So why are they so crazy? Why can't they find a good equilibrium where they can keep the theft going, while at the same time, you know,
it gets a matter of competing for big pharma may, you know, it got its share this time, but you know, it might have said before that, I said, well, when am I going to get my cut, right? Then, you know, other industry conies, you know, are trying to game it toward in their benefit, and you get just too much pressure, you know. You know, why does the government deficit keep growing? You know, power greed. You know, is it all just academic that they're like, oh yeah, well, we think that we should spend more, you know, or is it just because they're all grabbing power and money as fast as they can? You know, Hans Hermann Hoppe wrote a book called The Democracy is the God That Failed. In this book, he pointed out that one of the things that makes democracy worse than a system of monarchy is that, at least in a monarchy, the king owns the property and has a long-term view. But in under democracy, you have a revolving door and a short-term view that's encouraged, and that's really the nub of it. And it presents itself eventually in Wall Street, at the banking level. Everybody starts to develop a very short-term view. I remember when I left the brokerage business, my view was gold in the next 2 or 3 years is going to start to smoke. And they told me that was too long a term review. I needed a 6-month view. Right.
Wow.
So it was, it's that kind of thing. That's where the greed comes in. And that's why if you look back on a time series, every cycle in money growth tends to be higher than the last cycle, right? Just so in terms of percent growth.
So every time that there's a new innovation within the market, it provides an ambiance for people to justify the debt-based system further. And we find that this horizon of theft, this historical time preference for theft, like you just very well described, is encouraged to be lower and lower because of, you know, you explained the way that democracy works and the way that just the debt-based economy works in itself, that encourages the financial sector to become very short-term oriented because it is a debt-based system.
Well, they are artificially lowering time preference rates in a sense, right? They're by lowering certain interest rates and exerting that influence throughout the interest rate area, they're playing with time preferences, right? They're encouraging more short-term thinking that way too.
So there are two worlds within crypto, and there's a world within crypto that has a very low time preference. And those are guys like us, more guys that like see the value in Bitcoin and Monero things. And we see, we say things like we are stacking sats for our grandchildren's grandchildren, right? And then you have another world in crypto that is what we call the degenerate world that really is exemplified by the Sam Bankman-Frieds, the FTXs, where it's all leverage on top of leverage, and it's just this craziness on overdrive.
Yeah.
And we get
most of the flack.
Yeah. So maybe if you could describe that, because it's interesting that there is a divergent world within crypto. Those that are investing in crypto in a very sound and educated way, and people that are just desperate, that are trained by the debt-based economy that they come from, and they see crypto as an opportunity to make generational wealth in a matter of 24 hours now. I'm hearing people, Ed, nowadays coming into crypto that they with the mantra of, if it's more than a $10,000 market cap, I'm too late to the party, right? That's literally how short-term there and how high their time preference is at this moment. Do you foresee this Do you foresee this craziness to continue?
Let's rewind a little bit because we started a topic that we kind of diverged off of.
Sure.
So when I asked what a Federal Reserve note was, what money is, you know, the cash is a Federal Reserve note, but 94% of money is bank deposit money, right? It's a bank deposit liability. Okay. So if all that's going to happen is the Fed is going to say, well, instead of issuing cash, if you want to take your money out of the banking system, that's why they issue cash, right? If you go to the bank and you want cash, well, if they don't have enough in the vault, the Fed has to print up some more. And that comes off the reserves that the banks have at the Fed.
Okay? You want to hear something really funny, Ed?
Sure.
Okay. That as a crypto person and a guy that's been in Bitcoin, like pretty much my whole professional life. So when people talk to me about the banking system, to me, it's such a foreign like description. Everything that you're telling me, it just seems like the Twilight Zone, right? Where it's like the normal for everyone else. For me, it's like the weirdest thing you're describing me right now. Carry on.
It's a broken, corrupt model. You know, they've got bandages all over it. You know, if you think of the model, it's on crutches, you know, supported by the Federal Reserve and the taxpayer who, and actually say not the taxpayer, but the user of the currencies of the Fed. So that's the thing, you know, it's not, the inflation tax applies to the users of the currency, right? It's like we get taxed on the income, we get taxed on profits, we get taxed on every transaction and the use of the currency, right? That's how they steal in those ways, right? So that's what I mean by the system of theft. So it is a very broken system that they have. Try to envision. So the Fed has a monopoly over the issuance of the Federal Reserve note. None of the banks can issue the Federal Reserve note. The Fed has to issue, right?
Right.
And the bank, based on the bank, the reserves that the banks have at the Federal Reserve. So if a CBDC just means that instead, in lieu of the actual paper, you're going to get a token that represents the paper, then it's just a token. It's a fucking stable coin. I keep trying to make this point, right?
Right.
Is that not wrong, right? Or wrong?
No, it's pretty much yes.
And we know that the CBDC is not going to be cryptocurrency. We know it's going to be a centralized ledger, right? It's not going to be decentralized.
Right.
Right. It's not going to be DLT, right?
Yeah.
Correct. Right. I mean, if it is, okay, that's interesting. Then it's like, then you could at least say that the CBDCs are sort of like actual digital cash, but you wouldn't be able to track and trace them if it was decentralized and based on cryptography.
Right. Right? Yes. If they're private. Okay. Yes.
So the whole idea, the way that they're fighting cryptocurrencies with this idea of central bank digital currencies is they're saying, well, the problem with cryptocurrencies is they're full of scammers. You need us, the same argument as they had with gold. You need to trust us with your money, and that's what we offer, right?
The interesting thing is that the scammers in crypto really came in through them, like SBF with FTX. It's really that Wall Streetization of crypto that really created an environment of just replicating their antics in the crypto space.
Sure. But I mean, who the fuck cares? The dollar was first used by smugglers and fucking robbers and whatever, right? And in many countries around the world, for many, many decades, wherever you had communism, the people that had a black market on the where they used the dollar, they weren't good people, right? Not always. Sometimes maybe they were, but anyway. So this is the thing. So all right. So if that's what a central bank digital currency is a stable coin, decentralized stable coin. Well, who the fuck cares, right? If it's a centralized token, it's still just a token, right? And so token for cash, so that's 6% of cash that's floating around there. Okay. So if that's what it is, then the strategy is just another way to go cashless without having to use force. Okay. They think, okay, well, if we can create that kind of a CBDC, then maybe we can get people into the banking system that don't usually, that are in cash right now. Okay. Voluntarily. You get that? Voluntarily.
Yes, correct. That's their only hope, really.
Right. So that's what I'm saying. That's one of the reasons that they're promoting the CBDC in that form. Right. So if you define it that way, that's what it is. Okay. Now, if we define the CBDC as what it really implies and what the its original creators defined it as, and what some of the big players defined it as, is a deposit liability that's at the central bank.
Correct. Yes.
So if you want to centralize the banking system more, right? And if you want everybody tracked and traced and all that, you got to create a situation where the central bank is offering deposits to everybody.
Yes.
But that's just not the way it works. Central banks offer deposits to banks and governments. They've never offered deposits to everybody, except under the most socialist system where you have one national bank and everybody else's branch.
Like in Argentina.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Or I remember in some parts of Europe back in under the USSR's day. Right. But to get there, you have to destroy the banking system. Okay. Now you say, well, that may be what they want. Okay. Well, fine. Let them do that. But do you think the dollar is going to stand a chance as a reserve currency if they destroy the U.S. banking system?
No, of course not.
And they guarantee all deposits and centralize everything?
Yeah, right? it would be an assault on commercial banks, yes.
So they would, by losing the dollar as a reserve currency, they lose everything. That's another reason that the theft rate has been picking up lately, is because they know the dollar is going down. So it's like they're just trying to take whatever they can before the ship sinks, right? There's a sense of that in the air, definitely. Right. I sense that.
Yes.
So the global central bankers are taking advantage of this, and they're trying to think that their one world currency dream could come true through a CBDC. They've been trying for decades, this one world currency dream, and now they've got a CBDC. But the reason that you can't have a one world monetary regime is they all disagree on what the goddamn monetary policy is going to be, right? You can barely get all the European nations to agree on monetary policy, let alone the whole world, right? A one-size-fits-all monetary policy for everybody, right? How are the Chinese and the Americans going to agree on the right interest rate, right? Theft rate in terms of money supply growth, you know? Who are they going to steal from? The Chinese citizens or the American citizens or who? Wherever their circulation of this contrived currency would be, right? And it just, and for that reason, it just wouldn't work, right? So the only way to have a global reserve currency is if it's voluntarily adopted. The dollar was voluntarily adopted as a global reserve currency originally, okay? It had a strong position, a natural voluntary position, for most of the last century until the economy in general started to become in terms of international payments, a net debtor, right? You know, that doesn't mean a lot, but what one thing it does mean is that more dollars are going to leave the economy than come in, right? So that's begun to undermine the dollar. The transition to complete fiat in the 70s and 80s, you know, it's been downhill from there after a period of reprieve. You know, every once in a while you get this big drop, you know, and then sideways, you know, like, you know, 70s drop, 80s and 90s, 2000 to 2010 drop, 2010 to now, sideways, right? And then we're going to have another drop, basically in terms of the monetary value of the dollar, even on the foreign exchange markets, right? So the global central bankers that are dreaming up that are promoting the CBDC, they've only been doing it for three, four years, since 2018 now, because the Chinese gave up on promoting the SDR. They were in this century, the Chinese picked up on the SDR and they were promoting it because they wanted to get away from the dollar. But now they've abandoned the SDR and they're going with the BRIC, right? But the BIS still wants it doesn't want the SDR now. It wants a one world currency, but it's conceiving it as a CBDC. So, you know, the long-term plan is, you know, the BRICS are going to have their currency, the euro is going to have their currency, maybe North America will combine, you'll have the Canadian, US, and that was Mundell's dream 20 years ago, was to have, they were going to call it the Amero, that's right. Combined Mexican, Canadian, and U.S. currency, right? And then from there, they can try to ascend into a single currency. But like I said, they're going to have problems with monetary policy in doing that. So, you know, going the bigger blocks in terms of, if a currency is adopted voluntarily, it could be a global currency. Its circulation is unlimited, right? Because trade can expand anywhere, right? But if they're trying to force a currency coercively and trying to create a government currency, you're doing it because you want to control it. And you want to control it through monetary policy, right? So, and that's politicized. So you're going to have different monetary policy conflicts between different nation states, right? So it's just not possible to have a government-driven global one reserve currency. The dream of the beast currency is all for naught, because really the beast currency is the system they have now. The system they have now is the best they've ever had and the best they ever will have, right? So when this system goes down, that's why I'm optimistic. You know, I see how greedy and stupid they are, and I see how they destroy everything that is around them to the point where a lot of people think they're doing it on purpose, right? And sure, some of them are like, yeah, I love to watch this destruction, you know, and so on. But in the end, they can't manage chaos any better than anybody else. And, you know, I understand the idea that, you know, they might thrive on chaos, but they don't. Chaos really bites them in the ass in the end. That's what I've learned through my life. I've seen it many times. You know, when the Russian communist system fell, when the Chinese system fell, there was karma, right? You know, the people got their just dues some way out of those pieces of shit, right?
So. So when do you think this will happen, Ed? When do we see the collapse of all of this BS degeneracy?
Well, I think the CBDC push right now is the only real value it has is the same value that the SDR had, which was to dissuade gold bulls from being too crazy about gold because they got the SDR, right?
Right.
Their message to the public here is, you know, don't worry about the wild and crazy crypto market. We got you. We got the CBDC. You guys want a digital coin? We got one, the CBDC. They are arrogant enough to believe that that's going to work, right? But like I said, they haven't defined it properly. And there's all sorts of risks. The IMF knows it. That's why they said, okay, it's going to take us about 5 years to figure out a guide to give to nation states on how to build and implement a CBDC. 5 years.
5 years is too long in crypto.
I mean, yeah. Well, because they're stalling. That's why it's like the American Bankers Association keeps telling people, and there's 2,000 banks in there. They keep telling people that they don't want this. They don't see it as solving a problem, the CBDC. And they see too many risks to the banking system as a result. So what I'm telling you is if they try to implement a CBDC as a stable coin, who gives a fucking shit, right? If they try, you know, I mean, you know, it'd still be a shame in a sense if they use force to outlaw cash. But if they just want to try to voluntarily lure people out of cash with a CBDC, I don't care, right? If they try to implement a CBDC in the sense that they open the central bank for business to retail people, to the people, then they'll destroy the banking system and they'll destroy the dollar, right? So if they do that, I see nothing but rays of sunshine on the other end. I mean, there's going to be a lot of blood, you know, first, but I'm very optimistic on the ultimate transition because we got prices for everything already, right? And because there's well-known prices and well-established prices for things, even though they're in terms of fiat currencies, the transition to another currency in terms of pricing is going to be very quickly if people do it, if people adopt it. So they can only try to slow that down, but you can see it happening, right?
So do you see cryptocurrency right now being ready to receive the global economy after a dollar collapse?
No, not yet.
And why is that?
I think that'll be an extended period of probably a one generation long transition. It might involve a war first. I don't even know, right? And as a speculator, I have a number of scenarios, that number of futures that I see. Okay. And I try to handicap them, right? So I have an optimistic scenario and I have pessimistic scenarios, right? In the short term, I see nothing but pessimism, right? I see some signs of hope in the pushback we've seen rising out of COVID, and against the gender, not that I give a shit about genders and all that crap. I mean, I know that the concept of a gender was created by a psychologist who sort of corrupted the idea a lot, and I know it's not scientific. So, you know, to me, it's like, oh, whatever. But I don't care if people want to believe that stuff, whatever they want. But you can see the pushback against the coercive nature of that movement, right? Which is their pressure, peer pressure for us to all accept things, accept their way of life, and to push and to allow children to make decisions on that affect their whole lives. Which is fine as long as the parents are involved, but they're not, you know, as you know, often. And just the promotion. I mean, you know, when I saw that one clip where this guy came into the gymnasium, his a father, they didn't even show us what they were dressed like, but that was the sick part. I don't know what was going on in the gymnasium, but all the teachers put out their rainbow colored umbrellas to block the video. How dare they? Like, it's a fucking public school. How dare you hide what you're doing to these children, whatever it is that is there, right? Right. So, I mean, I don't care about story time from a tranny and stuff like that, but then why are they hiding it with their umbrellas if that's all it is, right? If there's nothing to hide, right? Let's turn it back around on them. If you got nothing to hide, right?
Right.
You know? Right.
So you're saying that you see a positive pushback from these Marxist initiatives of totalitarian mind control and financial control. What horizon do you see? How much longer can they keep stealing and keeping this theft machine going until it just gives out completely? Like, what's the longest that this could
be? Sorry to interrupt like that, but yeah, that's a very good question because, I mean, look, If you zoom out and you look what they've done with this policy over the last month, they've impoverished middle classes in many South American countries, in many African countries. They've wiped out the middle class with just not with socialism, just inflationism.
Right.
You know, I mean, socialism is the natural outcome of that, right? And that's what we worry about. And that's what Hayek often warned about. He said, the problem is the governments cause the central banks and the government economic policies causes the misery, the recessions and the busts, but they're always blamed on the market.
Right.
So each step of the way down, more and more people are like, this market system, it sucks. We got to get rid of it. The market system, it sucks. We got to get rid of it. Right. And you know, not one single one of them has thought it out in terms of what can replace it. Right. And what tends to replace it is the socialists, because they always have a plan.
Right.
They always have a fucking answer for what went wrong, even though it's their friends that caused it. Right. So that's the negative, right? But again, I think the internet started a period of freedom in terms of seeing all of this, in exposing these systems for what they are. Okay. I think the internet played a role. So we got to really keep the internet for ourselves. We got to keep them from taking it back. Okay. All right. And if we keep it for ourselves, for the people, then we can continue to expose them, continue to educate the masses. And that's the only way. And I see that taking a generation, but if that happens and people just stop listening to these assholes and the merchants start pricing their stuff in other currency, like cryptocurrency or gold or whatever. I want to see that. That's the world I want to start seeing, right? This march to war that we keep seeing, it keeps getting thwarted, which is good, right? So that's a positive, right? Even in the Ukraine now, they're losing credibility on that conflict, I think, right? So I see those are the sources of optimism that I have, right? I think if you think that they control everything and they decide everything, then you can't be optimistic, right? But if you realize that they overestimate themselves, they have they're full of arrogance, and they shun economic law, which turns around and bites them in the ass. If you realize those things, then there's some reason for optimism.
Right on. So, do you have a timeline? Because I know that's what everyone's asking right now. What does Ed Bugos think? Does Ed Bugos say, hey, definitely within 20 years, something's got to give, or 10 years, five years?
How I like to say is, the dollar collapse is not something we're waiting for. It's something we're living, right? We've been going through it for 50, 60, 70 years. The whole system has been falling. Sometimes the dollar falls less fast than the others, sometimes more fast. Right. And on the foreign exchange markets. But in real time, it's all these currencies are collapsing. Right. And you never had a period like this in history. Nowhere right. You can look back in history. There's never been a global rampaging of inflationary destruction like there is now. But we're normalized to it. Right.
Right.
So the timeline is, I don't think it can last, more than a generation. Like I said, I think we're in the final throes of it. Whether that results in, like I say, the people just kind of going, fuck it, let's just, start to move towards a free market system, and adopt the currencies that don't tax them so much, right? If that's one future, right? The other future is that, there's things that we can't always foresee, right? The way that the game evolves, right? They don't control it, but they try to. And so every time we have a bit of an edge, they come back. And often they come back in ways we don't foresee, right? And then we come back in ways they don't foresee, right? And that's just the way it is. But this system is dying. And our strategy is positioned to benefit from either a cyclical move or a structural move. Do you get what I mean? Right. So
please explain that to the audience.
Well, if it's just another cycle, in commodities, in the dollar, in cryptocurrencies, we're positioned for that. So if the end of the system is, say, two or three cycles away, we're still positioned to benefit from the cycle, even if it's not the final cycle.
Right on. Yeah, a lot of us are actually, it's funny, Eddie, because it's a lot of libertarians have just been waiting for the final cycle for the past 20, 30 years.
Trying to say it's not about the end game. It's not about the dollar collapse is not something. It's like we're waiting for it to happen, man. I mean, if you look around you, it's been happening for your whole life, if you're my age.
Yeah, I mean, that's very sobering. And it's sad because we are going to start seeing more and more confusion of people becoming more and more desperate as this thing accelerates.
Yeah.
And I think that's really the reason why we are doing what we're doing with the dollar vigilante and the crypto vigilante.
Yes.
And it's to provide a place where there is a sound reasoning, where we're having these conversations, where we're actually not going by what the mainstream lunacy of the day but is telling you to do, but rather to take that step back and really take things and look into things the way you described them very well, right? To ask questions behind not just the proximate causes, but the more fundamental causes, the causes that are not seen, that are not apparent.
Yeah.
And so
I think there is also a larger thing that goes on here is that, you know, when I say when we make our advances, when our side makes progress, one of the ways they splinter our side is through this kind of fear-mongering with the CBDCs and stuff, right? You know, I think a lot of these guys that go out there and they're creating these fear videos on CBDCs, I think it's meant to sort of corral a certain part of the herd away from the rest of the herd, right? They use fear. They use fear, right?
Right.
Use fear to separate us all the time, right? When we had, when we were gaining ground with, when Ron Paul was still in his political suit, right?
Yes.
Before Trump, right? Well, Trump came along and split our vote, split our camp, right? You think that wasn't on purpose?
I agree with you. I think those psyops happen always on both ends.
Right.
Yes.
So I think that the CBDC in that way, just like the SDR was, is used in a sense like that, right? I think you just have to look at it and say, look, they have the ability to track and trace us already. They have the ability to put us on ESG plans already. What's been holding them back is not the damn technology. It's economic law and basically real law, right? We still have some laws to protect our privacy. You know, if the bank shuts us down, we can appeal to the law, right?
Right.
You know, not every country has that, right? A lot of South American countries and African countries and European countries, they don't have those kinds of laws that protect individual privacy, right? We still have those laws. And that's why this fight is not technological. It's not a matter of who can make the better technology. They can't create money. Money is for the people. It was created by the people to foster their exchanges. Governments and the people at the top, they don't give a fuck about money. They don't care about, they look down at the markets. They think, oh, that's for the masses, right? We do things differently up here. We just decree things, right? You know, money for them is a pain in the ass. It tracks their budgets. You know, we can see in terms of money how much they're overspending, right? It's a pain in the ass for them. They have to acquire money to get things done. It's a pain in the ass.
That's very encouraging, Ed, because it gives us a lot of motivation to realize that money is not something governments can dictate. And it gives a lot of hope to the cryptocurrency space in general, because there's such positive energy, such positive grassroots energy that comes with these technologies that really give us hope. Now, Ed, what's your favorite cryptocurrency?
Well, I have to say Monero.
Right on. And why is that? Why Monero?
You know, well, obviously because of its privacy default, and otherwise it's exactly like Bitcoin to me, except for that and a few other technical differences. And it's and it aims at creating a fungible money, right? Which is, I think, the important thing. Not that it has doesn't have its flaws, right? And I'm still a buyer of Pirate. I think whatever our favorite currency is today, it still may not be the one. There may be something in the future, right?
Oh, right on. Yes.
Right.
Of course.
But what's important is the seamless transition from one money to another. So that's why competition in the space is really important to me, right? I want to foster that. The more coins, the better. It doesn't matter that there's 1,000 coins out there, right? Only a few of them will catch traction. But then from that morass might come up a better one, a better idea, a better money, right? Why can't we always have better money? You know, we have the ability to do that. And as long as, you know, like I say, as long as prices exist, as long as prices already exist for goods, you know, changing from one money to another should be seamless. The only reason it's not is because of all the obstacles these assholes put in the way of us doing that kind of thing.
So in this journey of yours, now you find yourself being a pioneer in the area of newsletters with this new product coming out of the crypto vigilante and the dollar vigilante, the VIC. I do not know of any newsletter in the planet that is doing this. And I think it's because it's a proper response to the times we're in. There's so much noise on the internet. There's so much information out there that this really provides an ambiance of research in real time where people are going to be able to talk to us. What are your hopes and dreams for the VIC now that we're approaching the eve of it?
I'm excited about it. I'm hoping that it becomes an elite club. You know, like we've talked about, we're limiting it to 50 people. I want it to be an elite club so we can be a force in the market, right? A lot of newsletter writers right now, and they follow the model of media in general, which is they're accessible to the public. But there's a wall between, you know, even our newsletter generally, you read it. How do you get a hold of Ed Bugos, right? Or Jeff Berwick or Mr. X? How do you get a hold of these guys if you have a question?
Right.
Well, in the VIC, you got us right there with you, right? We're all working together. It's going to be a work in progress, right? We've got to figure out how to make it what we envision, right? And the first 50 people that are going to be in there are going to probably be instrumental in helping us, right? They'll probably be people who work with us to make it a better club, right?
Right on. Yeah, it definitely is a pioneering event. Nothing exists like it in the market. And it goes to show that the market desires something like this, immediate feedback, because of how crazy things are. Things are happening so fast, especially in the area of crypto, that if I were to leave my screen for a day, I would be completely behind.
Yeah, and it feels like that. It's not true, but it feels like that. Yeah.
Why does it feel like that?
Well, it's just because there's so much noise coming at you. Right? So much noise, right?
Yeah, if only there was a VIC for me. A place. But I think I'm gonna nourish myself out of it as well. But
that'll be maybe our next product.
Something for us? Yeah, that'd be great. Because what our job is
a trip in the Caribbean. Let's get a boat and have a trip in the Caribbean.
Hey, why not? I'm down. I'm down for that.
I don't know if we can fit all 50 people though on a boat.
We get a big enough boat. Ed, I really want to have you again on the show. I want to get more into the nitty-gritty of the cryptocurrency space itself and how it relates to the traditional financial markets and the Austrian perspective on things, because a lot of people in crypto are finally beginning to realize the importance of Austrian economics and everything that we talk about. But there's still a very ethical approach. And I know you've talked about this in the past. A lot of people compensate for their economic literacy by arriving to these conclusions, these libertarian conclusions and market-driven conclusions, through an ethical lens. So I think it's important to keep having these conversations so that we can nourish the crypto verse with a more grounded perspective, because it's so easy to just look at things and be caught up in the moment and not really take a step back and realize that a lot of it is just noise. So thank you very much for your time, Ed. Thank you for being with us.
That's what we do, is we cut through the noise. We do all the work for people, right? The portfolios that we design and construct, and we update people on the holdings, that takes work, right? We're saving people who have to work a normal job from doing all the work that we do and the thinking that we do. We do the thinking for people. When it comes to building the investment strategy anyways, right?
So. Right on. Ed, any last words of wisdom?
Just remember that we're in a period of deflation, right? In the causal sense. They're destroying money and credit right now because they're trying to shore up the credibility of the treasury market, the bond market, and the dollar. Okay, so they're in defense mode against the system that we see is dying, and that's one of the things that that they did that we didn't expect was come at this so strongly and destroy so much money. They've destroyed about $2.5 trillion in the last year.
Okay? Wow.
In raising interest rates up to the 5% level. So none of us would have figured that, like Peter Schiff was like, oh yeah, they'll never get past 2%. And even I was like, now when they get up to 2%, it'll wobble. But what was different this time is that the inflation broke out of the financial system. They like to keep the inflation in assets, right? They don't like inflation breaking out in consumer prices, right? So, but once that happens, that's when confidence in the currency drops. Okay, so they've been trying to rein that back in so that they can continue with their asset bubbles, right? But the problem is we've had a bull market in paper for almost 20 years now that arose out of an emergency zero interest rate policy, right? And the market is highly addicted to liquidity, which it is not getting. So remember, right now, we're in a period of deflation. And I know that my view is not exactly the same as everybody's at the Dollar Vigilante, but I think this year is going to be a year of downside for a lot of things. Maybe even crypto, but I think crypto's had a lot of its downside, so I'm not too worried about it, right? But definitely there's going to be things are going to start to unravel. The house of cards that they've tried to keep together while bringing down the inflation problem the foundation is starting to crumble, right?
So let me ask you one last question then before we leave, Ed. What do you make of BlackRock and what's happening with all of these giant financial institutions formally stating that they're stepping into crypto? What does that mean?
Well, that's what I started out saying. They came at us hard, right, Pushing the crypto market with regulation. But right. Isn't it suspicious that now they're all filing applications?
Huh. And what do you make of that?
What I make of that is what we thought right away. They want to shake this market out so they can get on board, right? Because Elon Musk tickled the market early in 2020, right? So, he started pushing it up too hard, too heavy. These guys, Wall Street wants, they love scarcity plays. It'll want to get on board this thing. And that'll deter a lot of cryptocurrency guys because they'll think like, oh, that means they'll control it. And in a way, they will have a lot of influence on its price. Yeah. They won't be able to control it though, right? You can't control any market because it's just too big of a market, right? But that's what a lot of people will think and a lot of people will see. But I see Wall Street trying to corner that market in the way that the Hunt brothers tried to corner the silver market and failed, right? You remember that story?
Please share it for our audience.
The Hunt brothers were a couple of speculators in the late 70s. I think it was the late 70s, early 80s, that tried to corner the silver market. And they pushed it up to, I don't even remember what the price was. I want to say $50, but I think that's a recent price high. But I can't remember what the high was in 1980. But whatever it was because of that activity. They were trying to corner the silver market, right? And they ultimately failed because the market, you can't corner and control a market. You just can't. Not a real market, right? You can if it's a phony market, right? If, you know, like some of the bond markets in Europe or in Japan, where they control all of the bonds, they hold all the bonds, you know, then you could say they control the market, right?
Right on. Awesome, Ed. Well, thank you very much for everything. And we're going to have Ed back as much as possible. Ed, I'm holding you to it. You're coming back.
Peace.
At least once a quarter. I mean, we need to have some Ed Bugos in here. Guys, sure. Thank you very much for your time. Thank you for tuning in. Ed, thank you for being with us. Until next time, peace, love, anarchy. Bye.